Okay, this is Frank Hymans interviewing Tony Prescott. Today's the 17th of August, 2005, and this interview has been conducted at Mount Coringai in New South Wales. This is for the Millers Point Oral History Project, and this is tape number MPFH14, side A. Okay, Tony, can we talk a bit about you first, for people who are listening to this tape, wanting to know something about who you are? Can you tell me first your full name?
Yes, it's Anthony Malcolm Prescott.
Mm-hmm. And where and when were you born?
I was born in Widnes in the north of England in the United Kingdom in 1947, 10th of September. And we emigrated to Australia in 1948 with my parents. And we came to live in Hunters Hill, which is where I grew up. And the family lived there till about 1972. So I went to primary school in Hunters Hill, and I was there during the period when the Claysville and Fig Tree bridges were built, and there was a lot of disruption in the suburb in the 1960s and that, and the heritage movement and interest developed during that time. So I think I had a lot of exposure to those sort of things, and obviously developed an interest in history living amongst it, and heritage at that time, so that probably triggered a lot of the interest then. And it was also a community which was, well, like in the olden days, so to speak, it was very, very close-knit, and you knew everybody, and everybody left their doors open, and you dropped into people all the time, and all that sort of, all those old-world cliches and that. It was a very comfortable place to grow up in, and a great sort of community, and all that changed a lot later, of course, after we left the suburb.
Right. So what was under threat, actually, in Hunters Hill at the time?
There were a couple of things emerging. I mean, originally the suburb developed in the 19th century as large estates with quite wealthy middle-class families living there, and as the moved into the 20th century and that, a lot of those families moved on or died off. And when I was growing up, there were some of the large old houses and estates there with the widows in them, and a bit of general decline and decay. So it was a rather... probably a bit of a poorer area in some ways in the 1950s, and the Woolwich End where we lived initially was quite industrial. One of my fond memories is remembering seeing the last ship being launched down at Maud's Dock at Woolwich. These are things that sort of stay with you all your life. They're quite strong recollections of an older Sydney that's no longer with us, really. And during the 1960s and that, of course, flat development was getting underway in Sydney, and Hunters Hill was an area of interest to people who wanted to knock down an old house on a property and build flats. So that's something that probably led to the formation of the Hunters Hill Trust, which was the local heritage and planning interest body. And the other thing, of course, is the Department of Main Roads built the Claysville, Tarman Creek and Fig Tree bridges, which involved a big swathe cut across the middle of Hunters Hill, and the demolition of some historic houses, including the National Trust property St Marlowe, and that aroused a lot of interest and protest. But in those days, of course, it went ahead. You couldn't stop something like that. So that obviously, those sort of things stimulate a lot of interest. And I suppose in relation to areas like Millers Point, of course, as growing up in Hunters Hill, you went into the city on the ferry. My father was in the Merchant Navy during the war, and his company used to use the Walsh Bay wharves and that. And it's those sort of areas we're quite familiar with, Balmain and Millers Point and the Rocks, and that they were part of that inner city fabric of life, I guess. And, you know, you weren't very far from it. Living down at Woolwich, one thing I do strongly remember is in the morning you'd hear the noise of hammers on metal over at Cockatoo, and that, you know, there were all these industrial sort of noises that you don't hear in Sydney now, and though they were quite strong things that left an impression on my youth, I guess. So Millers Point was a place I was aware of, and it was just part of that inner city life that we led, I guess. Mm.
So tell me about Millers Point. What was it like at the time?
I'm probably not the best person to answer that, but I when you're a boy, of course, you go around with your parents or your mother and that, so you don't stray far to look at places. But when I was in high school, I went to high school at North Sydney, and a couple of times I went over into the city for various things. You'd have to go over to Tyrrell's bookshop to get your textbooks and that, and one day I sort of wandered into the Rocks and looked around, and I was quite fascinated by it. And this is pre-redevelopment, and it was all quite authentic there and very, very Dickensian. And, you know, it made a very strong impression on me because Hard to Sell, even though it was history, of course, it was very genteel and bourgeois sort of history and that. The Rocks had a very strong feeling about it. And when you went into the Rocks, of course, you were drawn through the Argyle Cut into Mellors Point, and that seemed a little bit more salubrious in some ways, but the Rocks had a very strong feeling about it, which has really been wiped away. And I mean, I could go into that later, but you know, that's where I first became aware of them. And when I got to university in the late 60s and that, I still went over there. I took photos of old buildings. I was interested in them, and I took photos in Mellors Point and the Rocks and that sort of thing. So it was an early interest.
Tony, the Mellors Point of your youth, can you describe the influence of the maritime activities?
Yes, I didn't delve into it that closely at that time. I mean, I sort of recall it in many ways very similarly to the way I see it now. I mean, a lot of things have happened since then, but I mean, one of the remarkable things about the place is how it's remained unchanged. But of course, there are a lot of things now that weren't there in terms of the traffic and road work, traffic engineering and civic areas and that sort of thing. But in terms of the buildings and that, apart from being renovated by the Department of Housing, and that, because the Maritime Services Board back in those earlier days was a sort of benign landlord that didn't do a lot for the building, so there's a bit of decay. But quite frankly, not much different from what I see now. But on the Walsh Bay side of things, of course, that's all completely turned around. But by the 1960s, when I was looking around and that, I think the shipping activity was starting to decline because containerisation was coming in and so on. But I think my memories of the details are a bit slender. You'd probably have to be asking somebody else about that. I've got general recollections.
What's so interesting about Mellors Point?
I'm a historian by training, and the I mean, one thing I see in I work with the built environment, and that, and one thing I see is which maybe an architect doesn't so much, as historical layers. And the really remarkable thing about Mellors Point is the layers of history in it. This talking physical to start with, the like, it has so much evidence of so many periods of its history. It's not like something that was built in one big bang, like I suppose Paddington is to some extent. It's got some layers to it, but it's a narrower sort of band. But Mellors Point's got evidence that shows history from the early 19th century to the early to mid 20th century, and it's those historical layers which are very fascinating to me. And the other thing that makes it quite remarkable, of course, and has kept it cohesive, is the fact that the community continues to live there. Now, that makes it totally different from any other sort of historic inner city area, probably in Australia, because places like Paddington and Balmain and so on, obviously the old community that was there, working class community, very much has moved on, and the places have become gentrified to a very high degree, and they've changed, and these changes are reflected in the fabric as well. And Mellors Point's quite remarkable because the community's still there. That's really the thing that highlights it.
Right. Can you define the Mellors Point Conservation Area?
I was, of course, working in the Heritage Office and the Department of Planning's Heritage Branch for many years, and I was involved in the sort of formulation of heritage policy towards Mellors Point and the protective mechanisms. And the conservation areas are something that evolved rather slowly. Like I became involved in it in the mid-1980s after the Department of Housing had started to do its initial studies of Mellors Point. And I pretty quickly drew up a rough sort of working area to define the area, a boundary to define the area, which included Walsh Bay and Observatory Hill, because I saw them as quite integral, and that you can't separate them as a historical entity. And we had a boundary there to work with, and that's I think the first sort of area type protection that came along came in the City of Sydney planning schemes and that, and we sort of get that boundary adopted in there. In terms of the state level and the Heritage Council, initially we were I suppose, stuck with the notion of protecting individual buildings as much as we could, because under the Heritage Act they were still having trouble coming to terms with the idea of protecting a whole area and the complexities, the administrative complexities that go with it. because you could easily tie up a small office like that in administering such a complex small area when it had to look after the whole state. So really the next evolution of the conservation area that came along was the Department of Housing, I suppose, and it defined its own property holdings, which of course didn't include the whole of Millers Point Observatory Hill in Walsh Bay. And then finally, after I left the Heritage Office, I suppose one of the aspects of my work came to fruition in the terms that defined a state listing on the what they call the Millers Point and Dawes Point precinct, which excluded Walsh Bay but included most of the rest of the area. So it's something that's evolved, but it's now something that's in place at state and local level.
What's the importance of the sort of laneways, the parks, the street furniture, all those sort of attributes that the precinct has?
It's all part of an integral whole, really. You can't separate elements of it. I mean, this is the change of mindset that some of us had to work on with people in terms of perceiving Millers Point. They'd see the beautiful buildings and the historic buildings. They'd see them one by one, or they might see a terrace row or a group. But everything was historically interrelated, the parks, the wharves, the laneways, the steps and that. I kept on saying to people, this is one heritage item, this is one single heritage item. You can't take it to bits and say that's heritage. It's the whole thing is a single heritage item, like a great big building or something that consists of building steps, laneways, wharves, streets, trees, so on and so forth. So it's all integral, and the laneways and that are part of that, the steps. Mm.
So why is it actually an area of state heritage significance?
Because of its intactness and because the community's still there to sort of support that intactness, it provides such a strong documentation of early Sydney history or early Australian history, even that's quite unparalleled anywhere else in Australia. You can't find any urban area with that sort of intactness. That demonstrates so much early history in its physical fabric, and the way it continues to be owned by the, part of its history was its takeover by the government, the fact that it's still in state ownership as a single entity, it has a community living there, and that's just totally unique in Australia and very rare in the world, quite frankly, for a European-style city particularly. Mm.
Now, what's the purpose of the actual housing stock that's there? I mean, why were certain houses built, and is there a difference between the wealthy merchants' houses and the workers' cottages, and why?
Yes, yeah, it's a suburb that's had an evolutionary history. Of course, it started off as an area of waterfront activity, and the merchants had their stores and wharves down there on the water, and they. In those early days, in the early to mid-19th century, they had their houses there too, and they were quite wealthy people, so they built quite big houses, and they built quite big bond stores down on the water and so on. And so that was the first housing stock. And then the a lot of workers' housing, of course, developed alongside to service that as well. And that, so you got the two broad types of housing and the pubs and other supporting facilities that came with them. And then, of course, at the end of the 19th century, of course, the shipping trade was booming. There was new technology, steamships, and so on and so forth. And the Sydney Harbour Trust, which was the organisation that administered for the state the Port of Sydney and how it operated efficiently, and that they saw Millers Point as a key area. And by the end of the 19th century, I guess a bit of a crunch time had come that they really needed to replan the waterfront. Replan the wharves and the whole thing and that. And coincidentally, of course, the plague, an outbreak of the plague emerged. And of course, there's a lot of suggestion that the rebuilding of the wharves and so on had to do with the plague, but it was really, really a historical coincidence. I mean, the plague was really a symptom of the mess that things had got into in those areas. So the government took over, and there is a resumption by Sydney Harbour Trust and Public Works and that in 1900. And then, of course, as part of its planning, of course, and this was one of the marvellous things about it, what made it into a sort of corporate town or company town is that the Trust not only built the wharves, rebuilt the wharves and roadways and service areas there, but they recognised that had to be serviced by an adjacent community, so they reshaped all of that. So the merchants had long since gone. There were big houses there. They sort of were divided up into rooming houses or whatever. and the trust renovated the better of the 19th century houses, and they where they were substandard, they demolished them and built rows of model worker housing based on ideas that were quite pioneering at the time. It's probably some of the first public housing in Australia. And they used overseas models for the design of them, and that's this big long rows of terrace-type housing in Windmill Street and those areas that came about then. And, of course, it's been public housing since then, and the landlord was more interested in the port and neglected the housing, and eventually in the 80s the Housing Commission or Department of Housing came along and took it over.
1980s, yeah, but do you know much about the very early history of Millers Point? Can you tell me something about how it began?
Well, really, because it was in proximity to the early settlement at Sydney on the other side of the ridge there. It was a natural area to have waterfront use because of the attributes of the waterfront, the deep water there, and even though the land in Sydney sort of tended to slope steeply to the water, there are good areas like around Millers Point where there was useful flatter land and so on that they could use. So there were activities like whaling and so on that made use of these areas. So activity was sort of drawn over there, being very close to the central area of Sydney. Really, it sort of evolved like that, and then really started booming and developing as the 19th century progressed.
Right. Some of those cottages in, say, Merriman Street are pretty modest sort of places. Were they built for the maritime workers?
There's a mixture there. There's some adjacent, I think, in Bettington Street that were the ones in Merriman were, I think, 19th century. They would have been built for workers at that time, yes, yeah, but by private landowners, not the state.
What about some of those kind of stately homes in Lower Fort Street? Who would have lived in those places?
Yeah, well, they were some of the merchants and the city businessmen and people like that, because it was a desirable area at one stage. It evolved like a lot of inner city, that some of those the higher ridges around the early part of the city, like Darlinghurst Ridge and the Millers Point Ridge, and that were quite attractive areas to live. But as the city grew and that, they became slums eventually, and the wealthier people moved out to more salubrious areas.
Right, like the eastern suburbs, you mean?
Yes, yeah, or Hunter's Hill, yes.
Right, okay. Hunter's Hill, right, why not? The rocks has undergone quite a bit of sort of yuppification, if you like. Is Millers Point under threat of becoming similarly gentrified?
It's always been a worry in recent years. I mean, the rocks is in some ways a model of what not to do with Millers Point. It's but of course the political process at the time was that all happened a bit earlier, when thinking wasn't at decision making levels wasn't as evolved as it is now. And initially, I suppose, as is well known, there was during the Askin government, there was a proposal to demolish the rocks entirely and basically build an extension of the CBD with high-rise buildings and so on. And there were protest movements, and the green bands evolved and that sort of thing. And the rocks were saved in a sense, but somebody like me doesn't see it as being really saved. I mean, this is the I suppose a bit of a dichotomy that's evolved in among heritage professionals, and that initially there was that very architectural view of things, and people saw the pretty buildings and all that sort of thing, and they felt that if they preserved those, they'd preserve the suburb or the area. Well, that's fine, but ultimately a place has a feeling about it, and this is a very hard thing to convey, because a lot of people think very scientifically in that, and when you start talking to them about feelings and the way the place feels and that, they think you're a bit of a loopy and they don't listen to you. But I mean, it's something that we historians have to work hard to sort of demonstrate to people, because it's all part of documentation of history. I mean, when you talk about documenting history, it's not just paper documents and that. We heritage people work with the physical documents, which are what you see with your eyes, the things you can touch out there in the street. And the rocks, they felt they preserved a lot of that old stuff, and the bits in between that weren't so good, they filled with nice, what they call infill housing and that. And I suppose physically it all works all right, but somehow it's not the rocks. It's certainly not the rocks that I felt very strongly when I walked in there in the 1960s and was hit with this overwhelming Dickensian sort of atmosphere, very strong feeling of an old port waterfront sort of place. And now it's, well, I suppose Hollywood's been a term that's been used by some people to describe it. It's a, you know, it's like a Hollywood stage set. It's very pretty, but it's, is it history? Yes, a bit of it is history. But Miller's Point has still got the community there, a different sort of place. There's been a threat, I think, since the 1960s, ironically, one of the organisations that started the threat, I think, and this has been a bit of a source of angst, was the National Trust itself, which had a headquarters right up on top of Miller's Point, but never sort of seemed to acknowledge what was down below their feet there. And that, and they started off in the 1960s referring to it as the West Rocks, and they created a conservation area in their register called the Rocks Conservation Area, and the Australian Heritage Commission came along later and used the same terminology, and people started to think of Miller's Point as the rocks and that, and some of them still do. You can still see, I won't name any premises and that, there are sometimes businesses' premises that call themselves the rocks this or the rocks that, and this was a bit unfortunate in terms of creating a bit of a process of historical determinism, in that once you start calling it the rocks, the decision makers and the politicians look at the whole area and they think, well, this is the approach we've used in the rocks, we should be carrying it through to the other side. And and of course the rocks redevelopment, of course, is very commercial, and it's right on the edge of the CBD, which is a very high value area. The Australian cities have evolved like this, where they've got these intensely high value central areas and that, and money says everything, and if you want to preserve something, you're arguing against this multi-million or multi-billion dollar sort of underlay where everything has to be developed to its potential. So the rocks managed to strike a neat compromise there, in that it managed to keep some history, but it fitted into that scene where it worked, you know, to satisfy commercial interest in that, so people couldn't say this is a burden, financial burden on us, or economic burden on us. But Miller's Point, on the other hand, was right there also on the edge of the CBD, but it had public housing tenants in it, and public housing tenants, of course, since the 1960s, the poor things have been moved to places like Mount Druitt and goodness knows where, out towards Campbelltown and that, and the idea of having them occupying this prime land right in next to the CBD in economic terms was seen quite badly. So I think there was a bit of a plan movement at the political and planning level evolving, where the I think people were turning over in their heads the same approach as the rocks to Miller's Point. And by the 1980s, the Department of Housing took over from the old Maritime Services Board, which is now the Maritime Authority. And that was quite a good move in many ways, because it sort of secured the public housing interest. And also there were many good people in the Department of Housing at the sort of workface level who understood the significance of the place, and they commissioned a lot of studies and so on and so forth. And they've been really one of the greatest bulwarks defending Miller's Point in recent years, the fact that there's this group of interested people, professional people at that level. I'm leaving aside the community at the moment, because they were very important in this process, but I'll probably come to that. But they set up these studies and so on and so forth. So by the time a Liberal government came back in, the Griner government, with this very strong interest in privatisation and selling off things and that, and their attention was turned to Miller's Point as a potential area for getting a bit of cash in by selling off property. By that time, there were studies in place and there was a core of interest, and at the same time, a community interest evolving, that where the local community recognised that it needed to defend itself against all this and that. So together, I think there was a lot of mutual hand in hand there against this force that was emerging. So during my time with the heritage branch and that, we were trying to hold the reins, or participate in holding the reins of this to some extent and steer it, and I managed to get the Heritage Council to pass some very strong resolutions about the place, which they did in about 1990, saying that it was of state significance, that significance needed to be preserved by being kept in government ownership, the community needed to be kept there. We were saying all these strong statements without at that time being able to back it very much with legal force. And we were working in a very, very hostile environment, really politically. The Walsh Bay redevelopment emerged at the same time. I don't know whether I'm jumping ahead of you here at the moment, but that to my mind, of course, that took part of Miller's point. As I said before, I saw it as an integral thing. Obviously, the Walsh Bay wars were redundant technologically because there was a different style of shipping, containerisation and so on. So the logical thing for the Port Authority was to knock them down, but of course the Heritage Council, they're obviously significant, and we put a conservation order on them, so that protected them. So it raised a scenario of redeveloping the area while keeping the wharves, and of course the developers were coming along and saying, well, it's very expensive to keep the wharves. To do that, we need to do this on the shore side, which means demolitions and all sorts of things. So it was quite a dangerous period, and for us, I think, for Miller's point, and politically in that, the political influences were terrible, like those of us in the Heritage branch who sort of tried to hold the fort against it were threatened with our jobs and all that sort of thing. It was a very, very unpleasant scene. I mean, at one stage, the director of planning called me up and said, how would I like to be spoken to by the Premier about this, you know, meaning our work in the Heritage office trying to hold some sort of preservation in Walsh Bay and that. So it was a very, very, very difficult period and that, very, very, very stressful. And then but somehow we managed to keep on getting the message through. You know, it's like you work like a termite, you just keep going away and away at it. And there were quite a few things we did, like using the Heritage Act, which was a pretty weak act compared to some of the prevailing legislation in New South Wales. But one thing the Walsh Bay Conservation Order accomplished is that legally, when you put a conservation order on something, you can't demolish anything in it without getting the approval of the Heritage Council, and eventually this sort of stymied the developers to some extent, and the government actually had to change the legislation to enable parts of the Walsh Bay area to be demolished to allow the thing to go ahead. So we copped hell with this, but we had some very important support, I think, on the Heritage Council. Particularly Nigel Ashton, who was a former director of the State Planning Authority, Ken Cable, who was a historian, and John Ferris, who was an engineer and developer. They were members of the Heritage Council, and they were very, very strongly for Miller's Point, and they helped carry it through at that level too. And when you got people of that level saying things and that, you had a bit of force going there. So it was a very, very dangerous period, really, for Miller's Point, and I don't think it's fully resolved yet either.
Mm. I'll just make an announcement. This is the end of tape number MPFH14, side A. This is the start of tape number MPFH14, side B. There have been a lot of threats, haven't there, to Miller's Point over the years. At one stage in 1989, as you said, the Greiner government went on this privatization sort of thing and tried to sell off some of the houses. In fact, they put up for sale signs on a few of the houses without notifying the residents.
Yes.
How do you find that coming from a government?
Well, it was expected given the general nature of the government at the time. It's, you know, we knew, we saw that sort of thing happening elsewhere around the state, so it wasn't surprising that was their approach. And, of course, we at that stage, the Heritage Office is a separate organisation now. I left it in 2002, so which means I'm probably freer to speak now than I was then. But prior to about 2000, I think, about 1995, it was part of the Department of Planning or whatever it was called at that stage. So it was simply a branch within the Department of Planning. And we were basically ruled by the director of the Department of Planning, and their major agenda was, I don't know why it's called Department of Planning, Department of Development would be more appropriate because their agenda is development and that. So we in the Heritage branch had to facilitate development while protecting heritage and somehow getting the two together, which works quite well in a lot of ways. But a lot of the time, as I alluded to before, you resolve that problem by keeping an old building in a development, and that acknowledges the heritage. And a lot of developers, quite frankly, private developers, a lot of them were quite sophisticated and quite good on that. They'd do the economics and they'd manage to accomplish that, so it often worked quite well. It wasn't really a problem. But in a place like Miller's Point, when you're talking about keeping everything absolutely intact and keeping the community there and that, really you're working on a level that they weren't tuned into at the sort of planning and development level. This was something quite big, and it was a very political agenda. And even the Department of Housing, I think at the top level and the political level there, they were probably seeing themselves as that they shouldn't be in Millers Point because this was an area that it was next to the CBD and probably wasn't the place for public housing any longer because it was too high value, so to speak, in commercial terms. So I think even within the Department of Housing, you had a lot of tensions between this top political stuff and these people working at the coalface who knew how significant it was and that, and they had their own juggling act to perform. I mean, I can hardly complain about the Department of Planning because it must have been terrible for a lot of them within the Department of Housing because they wanted to do this and they were being told to do that.
So there was conflict between the two departments, was there?
Between
the Department of Housing and Planning?
Not at the top level, and not even at the heritage level and that. I mean, they've been great allies, but there would have been political conflict, I guess, in terms of objectives and so on. So, yes, it was a very difficult time, and the change of government from Greiner to the Labor government, the Carr government, that didn't change things an enormous amount.
All right. Now I wanted to ask you about the changing demographics in the area in Millers Point. I mean, things are changing there. The Department of Housing people are coming in. Are they having an impact on the heritage values and on the conservation values of the area?
I'm probably not in the best position to comment on some of that, but yes, it's sort of inevitable. I mean, one of the things we've always recognised when we talk about keeping the place with the community is that, unfortunately, people go old and pass on, and that, and you can't when you're talking about a community that's that has descendants of an earlier Millers Point community, and that, of course, it's not a totalitarian country or anything like that. You can't force people to stay there; they move on. The younger generations go somewhere else, and so on. So that traditional community, we recognise that. I think, or we recognise in the heritage area that over a very long period of time, that's obviously going to change, and I suppose one day in the future, very little of that community will be there. And Department of Housing may be there. Keeping it as public housing might be the best thing that protects it in the end. If the political scene doesn't become too adverse and force the public housing out of the area, that might help things. But obviously, the demography of it's going to change. It has changed. Again, I think there was a tension within the Department of Housing in that the upper levels, they probably wanted to bring other people or anybody in, and they were being told by the people who worked with Millers Point that this was going to change the community too much and so on. So probably some sort of balance has been struck, but I'm probably a little bit out of touch with the details of that and that. But it's something that's going to be a long-term issue, obviously, and maybe in the very, very long term, I'm talking about decades ahead, and that we might be down to dealing with physical fabric again and threats to privatise and so on. So it's going to be an ongoing issue.
What about the impact of the Patrick's stevedoring development? When they leave next year, and in 2006 they're going to vacate the place, what's going to happen to that area? There's some plans for that, and how do you feel about those plans?
That's down on the wharves on the Darling Harbour side. Yes, it is a background concern. I mean, it was a bit of a tragedy that just before the heritage interest came to bear on Millers Point, of course, back in the 60s and 70s, they demolished the finger wharves that were along there and the buildings along Hickson Road that serviced them and that, and there was the destruction of the Millers Point itself. And the cutting away of the cliff there and the loss of some of the old housing and warehouses and the building of the MSB control tower. So there were some unfortunate things happening there, but it sort of changed the area. But on the other hand, I suppose, again, speaking as a historian, there was a continuing port use there. And really it was just, when you look at it, stand back and look at it a bit, it was part of the evolution of the development of the port in the area from the early 19th century, because obviously the... if we take that preservationist point of view, maybe we should have preserved what was there in the 19th century on the waterfront before the Sydney Harbour Trust came along and built the Walsh Bay Wharf. So you can't stop that evolution because at least it was still port activity, because now we're faced with a situation where the port activity is going to go. And there's the issue of reusing it now. Everybody's going to have a good hard look at what's going to happen there. There's a lot of issues how it'll affect the not only Miller's Point in terms of having a possibly gentrified development right next to it like Walsh Bay and that, but also views of Miller's Point from Balmain and all those sort of issues, because Miller's Point, one of the things about it is the very strong visual aspects of it, and that very, very strong and that. And I appreciated this recently because I went to Tasmania on the ferry which left from those wharves we're talking about and that, and it gave me a heaven-sent opportunity to look at Miller's Point, and it really is, it's a very strong visual impression that you have there, so any development is going to have to look at that very carefully too.
Because it's going to bring a lot of new people into the area, like they're talking about 25,000 additional workers and residents.
Yes.
I mean, the whole of Miller's Point's got something like 600 people in it.
Mm.
So how's that going to, what impact do you think that's going to have?
It will have an impact. I mean, I've had people say to me that the, in terms of resident action groups and that within Miller's Point, and that which comprise the traditional residents of the area, and that I hear that from the high-rise buildings in Kent Street and that, just at the southern edge of the precinct, and that there are people, the possibility of people joining in those groups, and then because they come from quite different backgrounds, they've influencing what's happening there because they have they probably see the area quite differently. So somewhere like that, and the Walsh Bay Wharves and that, those sort of residents are going to view the area quite differently, having not had roots in the area, and seeing the whole thing quite differently, and probably more architecturally or aesthetically rather than recognising the community issue that exists there.
Right. Mm. The modification of Miller's Point by human activity has been quite severe, hasn't it, right from the beginning? From day one, the walls have been altered. Mm. Is that interesting from a heritage point of view, the way that the, say, Hickson Road's changed and the Argyle cuts come in, all those things have happened to it?
Yes, yeah. It's that modification of the landscape for that evolution of activities. But I guess the thing that's, we can talk about continuing modification, but on the other hand, one of the remarkable things about Miller's Point is that it shows those layers of modified land use up to about the 1930s or 1930, and then really it slowed down or almost stopped, and it stayed like that ever since. And that's one of the remarkable things about it. It's a time capsule from the 1930s in many ways, and further modification that occurs beyond that is going to change that again. So,
is there a sense of loss of history and sense of place associated with all those changes that are coming? Do people feel disempowered and disenfranchised by all these changes?
Probably older people do. I mean, I'm a great believer in the future, and the younger generations have to go out and make the world their own and so on and so forth, and I feel a bit reticent about commenting on some of those things because I grew up in a Sydney that I liked very much, and I don't like Sydney very much now. It has evolved in a way that I don't like a lot. I don't like this American-style sort of city. It's this sort of international city, they call it, that's evolved into. So, I don't want to sound like an old fogey when I express these views, because life has to move on and things have to change in that. But I think protecting Miller's Point is going to be a real challenge in that context. But it's probably really for another generation to deal with how they want to do that. We really can't dictate at the future. All we can do is try to do our best at the moment to have something there for the future generations to look at, to work out how they're going to deal with it, rather than lose it as we could have back in 1990.
Well, we almost lost it then, because if it had been sold off, and I guess this is due to the resident action group that was set up at the time, there may not have been as much left of Miller's Point as there is now. So is the place under constant threat, would you say?
It is, by attrition. I think nobody's bold enough politically to attack it head-on any longer, because really the consciousness of the significance of the area has been raised quite high. But what will happen is a process of attrition, and you see these little things going on all the time. It's like I used to be a teacher, and you get things that you're writing on the blackboard, and naughty children do things behind your back, and you're sort of aware of it, but when you turn around, they stop doing it. And there's little things that happen, like the Observatory Hotel development, which is next to Observatory Hill in Kent Street there, which was a bit of a tragic development because it destroyed a site that was quite significant. It had the old St. Bridget's school site on it and so forth, and they approved this building that was designed according to the best sort of architectural infill principles, so that it blends in with the terraces around to some extent and has the same height and everything. And we were involved in that with the Heritage Office. It was a bit of a tragedy, but we tried to have it approved in a way that fitted in and everything. So that was done. And then it sort of went further on in the process. Once you approve something, there's several more steps where it goes through engineers and the council and all sorts of things and building application and so on. By the time it got built, it had this little upwards creep on it and that, so it had like an extra floor added on top and all these funny sort of things and that. So when it was finished, you got up an Observatory Hill and you couldn't see over it any longer, which was not the intention. And there's these little attrition processes that occur all the time. There's the city engineers doing civic works on the streets where they do traffic calming measures and that, and there's a way of doing that properly in historic areas and still protecting people, but a lot of council engineers aren't attuned to doing that, so they do it in quite a damaging way, but they say they're being sympathetic, and you're fighting against it all the time, and it's only a little thing, and yet it's a big thing because it's a process of attrition.
Now, the rat plague was, of course, used as an excuse to raise great areas of Millers Point, wasn't it?
Yeah, well, I mentioned that before. I think it was a coincidence that it came at a time when the government was also planning to really replan and redevelop the waterfront to bring it up to current standards. So it was really a coincidence. Maybe it was an excuse, but I think that would have happened anyway because of the agenda at the time and the need to service the overseas trade of the port.
Okay, Tony, what's been the economic impact of having a maritime activity on the wharves and on Millers Point? What's been the impact on the city of Sydney itself and maybe the state of New South Wales?
A very major impact, really. It's been traditional to view Australia as a sort of rural country and that, but it's very much a seaport country. The coast has been a very big feature in Australian history, and the after the initial settlement as a convict settlement, of course, eventually agricultural and pastoral activities and mining and so on opened up inland, and this was served to feed a small local population, but export became a very big thing. So the seaports were tremendously important. It was the only way of getting things overseas during the 19th and much of the 20th century. So places like Millers Point were very important for that, and the really the development of the ports and the development of the railways to draw the produce from inland were two very critical things during the 19th century. I mean, railway development accounted for most government capital expenditure during the late 19th century. It was such a huge thing. People don't really understand that nowadays, and the railways drew everything to the ports. So the ports were critically important, and that's why the redevelopment of Walsh Bay, the Walsh Bay Wharf, for instance, was such a high political agenda in the late 19th century, because it was all expanding. The whole activity was expanding exponentially, and really the wharves that had developed ad hoc there and the support facilities were falling behind the growth of trade and that. So it was a very, very important thing. It was like maybe the development of a major airport or something, but much bigger thing, yeah.
Now, another very major change in Millers Point was, of course, when they built the Sydney Harbour Bridge. What impact did that have on the community and on the infrastructure there?
It obviously created a very major physical change, and ironically, it might have helped the identification of the area by separating it from the rocks, because it cut right through the ridge and separated the two suburbs quite clearly. It took away some nice housing and so on the ridge, but it probably, in some ways, it probably helped define the community more give it a very stronger physical presence in many ways.
By the separation from the rocks?
Yes, yeah.
All right, I see. That's how it got more of its distinct kind of...
Probably not to the locals. I mean, they would have understood the distinction, but to general perceptions of it elsewhere, yeah.
Okay, right, interesting. When the heritage buildings were demolished to make way for wharves, that was earlier on in the piece.
Yes.
And there were changes to the finger wharves, for instance, all those things. What effect has that had on the sort of landscape?
Do you mean at the end of the... in 1900 onwards?
Yeah, I would say from...
that sort of period.
Yeah.
They obviously had some effect. They probably helped define the changes even more, because they were even more major works than what had happened earlier. There were whole cliff faces cut away, and I suppose one of the problems I remember we always had in the heritage branch was explaining the concept of the Walsh Bay wharves to people, in that everybody looked at the wharves but they didn't understand it was part of an infrastructure that went inland as well. And they were... the Sydney Harbour Trust just undertook these absolutely massive works, cutting out Hickson Road and building bridges and creating terraces on which warehouses were built and so on, and finally a terrace with housing on it and so on. It really redefined the landscape in a very, very major way at the time. And as I said before, it's all integrated.
All right. Is there now pressure on the area because of the developments like Walsh Bay? I mean, that could be more built like that. In fact, there is one being built opposite Dalgetty Terrace now. There's a huge development. Are you aware of that one?
Not directly, but yes, it's going to have a continuing impact. There's no question about that. Yeah,
because you know, are you worried that more and more buildings are, old houses are disappearing to make way for very expensive apartments with water views?
Yes, I am worried. I mean, that's part of the ongoing pressure. Yes, yeah.
What can be done to stop that happening, do you think?
That would require political will, basically, to do things in a different way. I mean, there's always a solution to these issues and that, but of course at the political level and developmental levels, they don't always want to take what might be an acceptable path from a heritage point of view, because it's maybe it's too hard, or the economics don't stack up in the way they define the economics. And of course there's been a lot of work gone into on the heritage side of things around the world, into doing economic studies to define the economics of heritage in a way that shows that it pays for itself, you know, because if this is the way people are going to talk, you have to address it. But there are other ways of doing things. But you know, it's going to be very difficult, because the body politic in this state, like in a lot of Australia, isn't a very strong or highly intelligent one, sophisticated one in many ways. They won't look at things in too much depth.
Right, I see. Mm. Okay. What about environmental issues? Are there any environmental issues as well as the conservation ones?
I'm not sure how to sort of address that. I mean,
the impact of traffic on the community. Congestion. Pollution, are they issues?
I think those sort of developments would generate more traffic, certainly. Pollution is probably going to be marginal compared to what's there already. You're not going to change much of that. Yes, that's probably about all I could say on that.
Mm. Right. Okay. Can you talk a bit about the community's sort of shared sense of attachment to the place, the resilience, the shared values, that sort of thing, that happens to be present at Millers Point?
I know there's a lot of community feeling. The one thing that I suppose we found a bit frustrating in the heritage branch when we were trying to achieve what we were trying to achieve is that unlike some of the gentrified area where you got these strong, like Paddington and Hunters Hill and so on, you got this very strong resident action group that was a single group and quite strong in its push. In Millers Point, a couple of groups emerged. I think there was the Darling Harbour branch of the ALP, and there was there was the other Mellors Point Resident Action Group and that, and sometimes you wanted to bring them together to present a united front, and you didn't always get that. And, you know, because it's one of those things where the forces you were against were so strong, you really wanted to bring everybody together and push in the other direction. But certainly there's no question about the commonality of the feelings of the community about what was happening. It's certainly shared very much a community under threat.
Does that community have a very strong sense of resilience and asset ownership, that kind of thing?
I would say so, yes, from my experience. Mm.
Now, you said you worked in the State Heritage Office on Mellors Point. What exactly were you doing on Mellors Point?
I was appointed as the historian in the office about 1987, and history was one of the sort of weak sides of heritage administration. I mean, architects and town planners had the main running on it. And, of course, there are things that historians see as significant that a lot of other people don't, because they can see the historical processes and communities and social significance and things like that. So I sort of got to work looking at a number of areas of the heritage of the state to see what was significant that hadn't been very strongly addressed so far. And I picked up quite a few odd things like railway heritage and that, and the old Manly Ferry, the South Stain, and that, because people were forgetting those things, because that was part of the life of the harbour and that. And as somebody who grew up in the what I call the inner city, although probably somebody mightn't consider the Hunters Hill the inner city, but we were very much wedded to it, I was very strongly interested in those areas. And as I said before, I was very aware of Mellors Point and the rocks from earlier in my life, and the intactness of Mellors Point, that some of you, that struck you straight away, the fact that it survived so intact right next to the city. So I thought, this is significant. It's still got original residents occupying the area. It's going to be under threat because the original activities are winding back, like the port and so on. The MSB wants to get rid of it, so I became aware of that. I was sort of allowed to address all these issues the way you work within an office like that, as you, I suppose, you come up with, you go away, do your work, come up with an agenda of issues that you think the Heritage Council or the department should look at and say, this is it, and you write a report for the Heritage Council, and away it goes. And my reports about Mellors Point were very, very strongly worded, and they were picked up, as I said, by a couple of important allies on the Heritage Council, like Nigel Ashton and Ken Cable, and they carried it forward, really. So it worked quite well, and you were sort of, initially your bosses were sort of a bit at arm's length, because it takes a while to educate people about the significance, the complexity of the area's significance, and then they have their bosses above them with different agendas and that, so they get a bit worried about what's going on here, because suddenly you're not talking about protecting an individual building, you're talking about a whole suburb or village that happens to be right next to the highest value area in Australia and that. So, you know, these little alarm bells start going off and things and that. So it was a big push, didn't do my health much good and that, but it was a very stimulating time in my life. By the time I left the office, they were calling me Mr. Mellors Point, and that, and they'd sort of taken it up, and that's the great success, really. I mean, I thought, I can't keep this up forever; it just wears you out, and that. But progressively, other people started taking it up in the office, and now there are good people there who are, you know, as they have since I left, they've put a conservation order on it all, so they, you know, it's more widely understood now. So.
And this conservation order on Mellors Point, is it having an effect now?
I hope it'll have a political effect. I mean, I've always been a bit of an anarchist. I've been wary about conservation orders and that, because one of the things about heritage is it started off as a popular movement, and it's become bureaucratized. And now I work as a heritage consultant. I joke. It's not a joke, really. It's quite serious. I spend a lot of time helping people out of the web of bureaucracy that they got caught up into, because it's I ask myself, what have I done wrong in my youth? Because you sort of, this interest in heritage emerges, the bureaucrats and the planners get hold of it, they all like it and that, and it gets enshrined in planning instruments and everything like that. And the next thing, all these poor little people who own some boring little Californian bungalow out in the suburbs and that are being treated as though they own Rouse Hill House or Elizabeth Farm, and they can't do a thing to their toilet and all this sort of thing, and there's this horrible bureaucratic nightmare and that. And, you know, I feel guilty about it in a way. It's gone too far, but it's not me. It got hold, the planning system got hold of it, and planners like red tape and rules and all this sort of thing, and it's gone too far. But at the same time that little people are being pestered with that sort of thing, the government and big people are getting away with murder. You know, there's all these terrible things happen, you know, that the state government initiates or supports and that. So this double standard has always worried me. But at the same time, with Miller's point, they do keep it at arm's length a bit.
I'll just make an announcement. That's the end of take number MPFH 14, side B.